you for doing that. Just some footnotes. If you all are in need of some CEs for your credentialing, ALCA is having an annual meeting at the end of August, and Julie or Sarah will put it in the chat room. Our program will have CEs attached to it, even if you're not a member of ALCA. Also, the Western chapter of ALCA will be doing their annual conference the end of September, and their program will also have CEs attached to it. So if you need CEs, there's places to get them. Julie, if you need retesting, you want to tell everybody about retesting this fall, if they need retesting for their credential?
For the exam, well, the exam window right now, the application window is open for our next exam, which will be held in October. So if you know people who need to be certified, please pass that information on to them. The information is on the website for the application. And then most of you, I'm sure, would be renewing as opposed to sitting for the exam. But always reach out to the staff if you have any questions.
Okay, with that, I want to thank also some of the other board members of the NACM accrediting organization for being on this call. And Julie, do you want to do the housekeeping?
Sure. Just basically that I'm going to keep most phones on mute just to cut down on background noise. Yeah, but if you need to speak anytime, just unmute yourself or put a question in the chat. It's a smaller group, so everybody should be able to have a chance to be engaged. And this call is being recorded so that people who are not able to be here can listen into it later. So just so you know.
And with that, we'll turn it over to you, sir.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you guys for taking some time out of your Friday to listen to me or to chat. Today we're going to talk about cultural responsiveness and the role of the CMC. I'm kind of in that in today's climate and the irony of a middle-aged white man talking about cultural responsiveness is not lost on me, I assure you. And I don't know about most of you. My background is as a clinical social worker. I've been a social worker since the late 80s. I've been a clinical social worker for only 20 years. So the social work code of ethics kind of mirrors NACM's, which NACM currently follows the ALCA guidelines, if that was lost on everyone. And so, you know, I certainly in my training, I was a professor for 10 years, taught ethics. As we talk about, you know, our ethical responsibility as a social worker, as a nurse, as any kind of care manager, I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that we have that ethical responsibility from our professions. Certainly not least of which is the CMC through NACM, that we need to, you know, keep in the forefront of our mind, certainly in today's culture or in today's climate, the fact that we need to be culturally sensitive. I see Julie Gray is on the line. I know we had a chat on another call about cultural sensitivity or cultural training, you know, that we've all gone through as certainly as CMCs, as social workers, as nurses. The terms have always been kind of lost on me because I can never be, you know, totally culturally trained ever in someone else's culture, anyone's, by race, by, upbringing. Being raised again as a white man in kind of a German household, it's never going to happen. I have lived in South Texas for 26 years. I was just shy of a minor in French in college. A German heritage French speaking man in South Texas, I can still only say about 10 words in Spanish. And that's to me, that's abysmal. I really, and I'm, you know, I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, but I really, I should, I, if I'm going to live here, I probably should learn some Spanish. And that has hit me, you know, even harder, over the last few weeks. So, I do want to certainly open this up. I did want to make sure that everybody knew, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir that, you know, through NACM, again, we follow, by belonging to NACM, by being a CMC, we're required to follow the ALCA code of ethics and their standards of practice, which we are working on our own code of ethics. So hopefully that will, it's based on ALCA's. So, but that should be out hopefully sometime soon. But you know, we are called to respect, you know, a respect for clients and a right and their rights for dignity, and justice. We're supposed to, we're cautioned to not promote or sanction discrimination. Standard 6, under the standards of practice, call us to, you know, understand and be informed how our own personal beliefs and values will impact our practice. So, you know, hopefully we can kind of talk within that framework, you know, how are we impacting our clients? And I'll start with just a really quick story. I don't know if anybody knows Crystal Littlejohn. I don't see her on this call. She is a CMC. And she's also an aging life care manager. And I think she's a nurse. I don't remember. But Crystal has a practice in, is it Arizona, Julie, you know? Or Sarah? Sarah probably would know. Yes. In Arizona?
Yes.
And Crystal wrote a guest blog for Wide Awake Business. And I'm not trying to promote anything else that they're doing. But it was published a couple of weeks ago, and I'll post that. I actually opened it so that I could hopefully put it in the chat box. Of course, I can't do two things at once, so I'm going to pretend like I am talking. It's a short article that, and Crystal is African American, and she talks about the growing up in the military, her father instilling strong beliefs in them, and not really facing what she felt like was discrimination, either personal or even systemic, until her adulthood. And then she talks about that. And she talks about how in her business or in her practice, she hopes she's never been discriminated against. And that opened up a memory for me that about 15 years ago, there was another care manager here in San Antonio, and she has since moved on. But she was African American, and I got a call from her one day, and she said, "Hey, Byron, I'm standing in the driveway of this gentleman and wondered if you had a minute." I put him on speaker, she put him on speakerphone. It was a very uncomfortable conversation. You could tell for both of them. And basically she said, I need you to come take over this client. He really wants a care manager, but he can't work with me because I'm Black. So he wouldn't even let her in the house. And he blamed his wife. He said, you know, oh, my wife is so prejudiced. So I went, the other care manager was gone. By this point, I think I went later that afternoon, met with him, met with his wife. His wife was so demented. If she was ever prejudiced, she may have been. She could not put two words together anymore. And that doesn't mean she wouldn't have reacted, of course, to an African-American face. But it became very, very clear within, you know, 10 minutes that he certainly had, I mean, he held a lot of prejudice of his own that he was, of course, trying to mask with some politeness. The embarrassing thing is that, you know, looking back, I took him on as a client, you know, worked with he and his wife for a couple of months while we tried to get their issues settled and actually got her placed. And then he terminated services, didn't feel like he needed us once she was placed. But I never addressed his racism. And I, you know, could I have changed his, you know, 89-year-old mind? I'm guessing not, but I could have at least called it out. And so I'm just embarrassed about the way I handled that. you know, at, obviously at the most, I could have said, I'm not taking you on as a client, you racist bastard, but pardon my French, but I get, you know, he did need services. I think I honored the fact that even though he was, he and possibly his wife were prejudiced racist, they still required service and needed some help. Could have probably handled it a little bit better. And so I really hope moving forward in our practice, we do, you know, we serve minorities. We have live in a 50% Hispanic, almost 50% whites. And we have about 18% African Americans in San Antonio. And then of course a mixture of other. So hopefully I can be more sensitive to those folks. And I think like probably many of you, I've had clients where we're trying to help arrange home care and the, and we don't do home care in our business, but, you know, working through others and a family member will say, now, please don't send one of those, you know, she has to be able to speak clear English. My mother's very sensitive to anybody who speaks Spanish behind her back. Don't send any colored girls. My mother would not like that. And so, you know, we've certainly heard it all. And we have to address that. And I guess, so that leads off to, what do you guys see in your practices? And I recognize that we're not all aging life care professionals. We have other, many other folks in that hold CMCs. So I'd love if you'd like to talk and tell us, A, of course, introduce yourself. Tell us where you are and what kind of care management, and obviously very quickly, you know, if it's an aging life care practice, if it's mental health, if it's working with other populations, let us know how that connects and kind of what your thoughts are on how and where we are as CMCs. Anybody? No? Jennifer, you're laughing. I can see you. You could talk. Mary Kay, go. I can see you finding the mute button.
I'll start out.
Great, Karen.
I'm Karen Wolfram in Hendersonville near Asheville, North Carolina, Western North Carolina, aging life care consultant, have my own practice. It's kind of strange. My grandmother, who was 92 when I became her care manager, having strokes, and she was in the assisted living home where I worked at that time. Anyway, she had Black ladies caring for her there that were the aides, basically. And she at first was rather hesitant about that because she lived in the South in the 40s and 50s. And she would say racial slurs, you know, throughout her life. She was a wonderful, sweet, loving woman and very fun loving. But when my grandmother's condition changed and she ended up on hospice care, those ladies were caring for her. She ended up loving them. They ended up loving her. It was a good ending. And, you know, as she changed her condition, she didn't see color anymore. And it was beautiful. So there's a good story, I think.
That's a great story. Anyone else?
Byron, hi. I had sort of an aha moment this week. So I'm a certified care manager. I'm retired now. And actually, hi, Karen. I live in Hendersonville, North Carolina. So we're getting a lot of vocalization from the South today. I had an interesting thing happen this week. So being retired, and nursing is my background, I've been doing a ton of gardening because not only can you do it by yourself right now, but I'm actually working at a local church in an area that sort of the front part of the building is in a nicer area and the back part of the building is in a lower economic, like the parking lots are back there and some mixed housing is back in that direction. And working on this piece of the property that was a dump, it was really a dump in the back of the church. And it's been like that. I found out we just moved here a year ago. So it's been like that for 19 years in the back of this property. If it were, it would never have happened if it were in the front of the property, because the face of this church needs to present itself in one way. The back, it was that aha moment where it doesn't matter because look at the neighborhood that it's sitting in. It's kind of, if I wanted to call it something, I would call it an economic racism. And it was never overt. It was never thought of that way, certainly. It's a subtle kind of, it doesn't matter because look at where it sits. And I had, as we were cleaning up, pulling rusty metal and broken glass and wires and everything out of this area to make it into a garden, and 4/5 of it is done right now, I have had neighbors come over to me and say, you finally care about our neighborhood. It's striking to me how just ingrained some things are into us that it's not overt. It's not deliberate. It's in our senses and we don't even realize it. And I think that's what I've been incredibly grateful for the past couple of weeks. God bless George Floyd, that he has really, no matter all the other terrible deaths that have gone on with the African American population and Hispanic and everything else down on the border and all of this, I think it's really shaken me. Maybe this plague that we've got lurching around us has given us a little more time to stop and think. But I think I'm grateful that it's made me more aware that it's not just African American. It's not just, we have a lot of Hispanic in our area because we are a big gardening area and a big farm area here in Western North Carolina. But it's also an economic racism that we have to be very aware of when we are interviewing some of our clients.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. I think you've spoken to the systemic part of this. That, of course, I think is what's coming out as the issue, is that for all of us that have been, you know, turning a blind eye and saying probably all of the wrong things for decades, I think recognizing that if we haven't been part of the solution, then we're probably still part of the problem. And so what I guess that leads to the question, what do we do? What can we do as care managers in our own practices, in the systems that we interact with, both our professional lives and Mary Kay, like you, and in maybe the churches we belong to or the other systems that we interact with? What can we do? Nothing. We just can't do anything.
Well, my name's Tracy. If I can back up a little bit, because I kind of feel that I am pulled apart in a lot of different directions. My family is a bit unusual for this part of the country, where I have two daughters, both in their 20s. I've been a social worker my whole life, my whole adult life. My younger daughter interned at the same social service agency that I work at, so she has a pretty good understanding of what I do. My older daughter is actually a long-term foster daughter, And she is Black. And it's what's so strange is that my younger Caucasian daughter is angry at me for not taking a stronger stand with Black Lives Matter. And some of the things, you know, it just seems like in our city, there's been a pretty close correlation between Black Lives Matter and rioting, which has happened very close to our very old, beautiful house. Very, very close. And my husband and I almost got caught up in the rioting, physically caught up in the rioting. So it scared the kajibers out of us. My Black daughter is a sergeant in the Marines, and she is very active on Facebook saying, shape up, Blacks, you're giving me a bad reputation. And is saying, you know, don't be violent. Here's a U.S. Marine saying, you know, taking more of a pacifist stance, and is saying, you know, speak your mind, but do so peacefully. Be respectful. Treat people with respect like you want to be treated. And just a very different stance than Black Lives Matter has taken in our area. And so I got both daughters who think that I am not vocal enough, that I should be leaning more towards their views. And it's like, do you guys see how ironic this all is? And the other thing that I think is so strange is that in our practice, in our work practice, I think we go above and beyond helping out everybody. You know, just economically, we provide services that other people don't provide, period, across the board. And the only way that I can think of where maybe we need to bone up better is access. Because if we take a look at the percentages, across the board in our area, about a third are racial minorities. But we have fewer than a third clients that are minorities. And so there must be something there systemically where people are not getting access to our program. But yeah, I would welcome the term that my daughter comes across all the time, or it tells me, yes, you provide, you believe that you're providing good services, but it's gentrification. And it's like, I guess I just don't know what I could do differently. And so how do other people handle this gentrification, and what do you do to counter that? I feel like I have a lot of tough questions and I don't have a lot of good answers.
Well, I think you opened a great question. I'd love to hear from folks, because I think that's, I feel badly about the shaming, because I do think when I ask certainly when I'm approached with the question of what can I do, I don't think it means I don't need to step outside my comfort zone. I don't need to do, I'm not called to do something radical. I am not called to go down and march. I wouldn't march for almost anything. I don't like the heat. So, that's not what I do, but I'll, you know, letter writing campaign, you bet. Calling my congressman, doing, you know, but, or changing my personal views, or just reading a good book on, you know, on my biases. If I could get them, they're all sold out, but I'm waiting on the book Biased right now. What can we do? I don't know that any action is too small. So I don't think anybody has to be shamed into thinking, well, I haven't done enough. But what are we doing in our practices? And the gentrification problem is so true, Tracy. As an aging life care professional, our practice is you know, private pay. The population, we have, you know, 6 full-time care managers. We have almost 100 clients. But our racial stratification, while we serve, we have folks of all populations, it certainly is not representative, our strata. So what can we do? Karen, are you going to say something?
Well, one of the things, I'm the faith community liaison for my church and the local hospice. And through the local hospice, have brought them in a few times to do programs on making end-of-life decisions, getting your documents in order, because I feel that's a very important mission of aging life care consultants. And we even have an Hispanic, we have three pastors at our church. One of them's Hispanic, and his job is to, we have a Hispanic congregation within our congregation. And it's amazing how they segregate themselves. They sit in the back of the church, even though at times we have services where the Hispanic folks, it's in Spanish, part of it, you know, and all. They tend to segregate themselves. None of those people have ever come to the programs that I've initiated as far as, you know, getting their documents in order. And I've said to the pastor, can you encourage, this is important, you know, for everybody. So I see that our goal, almost mine, I'm still finishing that book of This Chair Rocks, to champion the problem of ageism. And that goes across colors, across economics. And that's all I have the energy for. And I think all lives matter, even aging lives matter. And that's going to be my focus going forward in my soapbox, because in just embracing everyone, not just people of certain colors or religions or nationality, but all aging people matter. And how can we make them, lift them up? And how can I change even my thinking about aging? Because it's ingrained in me. You know, it really is some really bad things that I'm carrying around. And I need to be better at that to help my clients. So, and I'm really opposed to all this, you know, rioting and destruction. When I see churches burned in the name of trying to improve race relations, that just really hurts my soul. So I lose empathy when things like that happen, when history is being destroyed sometimes with statues and, you know, yeah, some of it needs to be changed maybe, but let's do it in a peaceful manner, in an intellectual manner, not by just going out there and destroying things. I'm going to be quiet now.
Sorry, I just realized I think Byron might have gotten off of the close internet dropped, he said. So
he's coming back in right now.
Yeah, he's coming back in. There was a question on the chat from Julie Gray that just asked, does your leadership reflect the diversity of the community, and do your staff reflect the diversity of the community? So those were two questions that were there. As well. And Byron is back.
Sure. I'm sorry. My internet said unstable and it just kicked me off. So I'm sorry. That's okay. I will tell you, our leadership does not, our agency does not. We have, we have 8 employees, care managers and support staff. And we have one American Indian. We have no Hispanics. We had a someone from India for years. We had one of our care managers was from India, which is does not look like San Antonio. And so we have no Hispanics. We have nobody on our staff that speaks Spanish, other than, you know, ordering off of a menu. So and that has been, you'd think it was a bigger problem, but it has not been as big a problem as we thought it would be, but it is a problem on occasion, certainly communicating with our families. So anybody else?
Speak up. I work for a company called Sound Options in Tacoma, Washington. And
hello?
Our is pretty, I mean, it's not as
real.
As we would, you know, like to love it to be, but we do have quite a variety and mostly women, which is kind of cool. Not surprising in this profession, but I don't know what we don't have in truth. I mean, we have someone represented from the Philippines, from Thailand, we have Hispanic, we have African American. There's quite a variety, which is, I was one of the pull cards for me when I interviewed there. So I do have that as a pretty cool. And it does add to our conversations in, you know, these kind of conversations when we all come to the table. Sometimes they get a little heated, you know, having 12 different women at a table talking about important issues. But it's pretty cool to have that kind of team support.
Well, give Mary Lynn a hug, a virtual hug next time you talk to her.
I will, for sure.
Hi, this is Diane, and I'm in the greater Palm Springs area. And most of our population is either white or Hispanic. I do not have anybody. I'm a sole practitioner, so I have one nurse, two nurses that help me out. One is Caucasian, the other one is Middle Eastern. I can say sometimes I see some prejudice from my clients that does help me out. So sometimes they've been kind of rude to her. But this conversation just makes me think that I really need to look at maybe recruiting a Hispanic, you know, social worker or nurse to be on my team to meet some of the needs of that population, even though I've never really had anybody on my service that has been Hispanic. I don't believe, anyway. I've been doing this for 13 years, and so I don't think I've had anybody. But anyway, that's what's happening here in the greater Palm Springs area of California.
Good. Anybody else? Or how you're addressing? What was the other question, Julie? Because I came on just as I heard Julie Gray's question of, does leadership reflect? And my chat was cut off, so.
It says, it asks if your leadership reflects the diversity of the community and your staff. So basically, yeah.
Oh, so there was just one question. I thought you, okay, sorry. So anybody else on what we can do, should be doing, shouldn't be doing? What are there things we shouldn't be doing?
This is Tracy again. I am proud of my agency that we are very, very good at accessing interpreters in person whenever possible, rather than using a language line. And so I think that's helpful.
Wow. So how do you have, that's expensive. I worked for an agency that we did the same thing a long time ago, and we used in-person interpreters. How do you do that?
We apply for a lot of grants. Yeah, we do. And that's just kind of an ongoing expectation. I think maybe, I guess I can't speak to it more than that, but, of course,
great.
We take private pay, but we do a lot of grant writing too. I'm lucky that I don't have to do that myself.
Yeah, I worked for a hospital system in the 90s here in San Antonio. And when I first got there, and it was a 5-hospital system, it was a very big system. And when I got there, you know, we had a lot of Hispanic and other language barriers. And the hospital's kind of unwritten policy was, you find someone. So grab a housekeeper or, you know, the adult child's son to be, and they would literally say to be the interpreter. And I'm like, no, that's a translator. And I promise you, this 7-year-old doesn't know how to say gallbladder, let alone myocardial infarction. So yeah, we had a movement to get an interpreter service.
I think I'm a social worker too, Byron, and I've done hospital work, lots of mental health work in my background, and I truly feel like the best tool that we can bring, I totally resonate with some of your points of, you know, just the population that this profession sets us in. I don't feel like it's as culturally rich as previous experiences of my life.
No.
Worked in the ER a lot, so you just get it all there. But in truth, the main point is just, you know, like someone said a minute ago, every life matters. It doesn't matter where they come from, how they got to us, what their financial status is, right? Like that's been kind of a shift in this role for me. I usually worked with people without any resources, and then I come to work here and it's, you know, a totally different population, but that doesn't matter. They're still a person. They still have a story. They still have their own issues, no matter where they came from. You know, to Kathy's point or Karen's point, you know, ageism is real. Racism is real. Sexism is real. Like it's all there. And I just love to say, like, I care about people, no matter who you are, where you came from, where you're going. Like, if you want me to be a part of your journey, that's what I want to do. So that's just kind of my take, is each person, right?
Yeah, that's great. And so how do others deal with potential racism? So like my, I mean, and I'm not going to lie, we get this quite a bit in our practice where, you know, folks will say, I don't want to work with someone, you know, don't send us a caregiver of color, or, you know, when we'll refer to a geriatrician, and her name is Patel, you know, and they'll say, I don't know. How do you all handle that? I mean, I'm certainly not going to try and force someone with these beliefs into an interaction it's not going to work. It's going to make everybody uncomfortable, but how do we address those? How do we, I mean, do you all go along with that? If a client says, don't send me a black caregiver, you say, I mean, like in our practice, we say, great, we'll work with a caregiving agency and we won't send you one. But how awful for you? Yes. Life Links. You're muted.
Yeah.
There you
yeah.
go.
I'm Jo Singer. I work with Life Links Care Management here in the Nashville area. And we have a fair amount of black population in the around. And sometimes we do run into that with our clients not wanting a black person to come out. And I'm also a physical therapist and I've worked home health, so I've seen that happen as well. But we try, it depends if the caregiving agency doesn't have anybody else, then we, you know, we have a frank conversation with our client about, you know, you need this help and, you know, give it a try or whatever it is. We try to lead them along to at least give it a shot. And usually it'll work out. But if they understand that there isn't anybody else to come, then sometimes that works. But it's, as far as facing down their racism, I've never done it. And hearing this conversation today, maybe I will now. I'll just say that's not acceptable. But I mean, and like we said, we have private pay clients, which are usually the upper echelon, which decreases diversity. So it's kind of a fine line to tread.
My experience has been that you do. We run into families all the time who draw the line on who they want to come into the house, what they're afraid of. They can reach back to a life experience of somebody, you know, generations before, and this is what they're basing their decisions on. One of the things that I was very deliberate about with families, whether they had an objection, a verbal objection or not, I know sometimes you just have a sense that they're going to be nervous, is to provide as much normalcy, I'll call it normalcy. It's hard to choose words sometimes trying to describe this. talking to families about the personality and I'm talking about caregivers here that come into the house about, oh, I've used, you know, this is a caregiver that I know that was wonderful with another family, and I highly recommend them because they made this special dessert. You know, when I say making them a universal kind of a person, I guess, no matter their color, their cultural background, but trying to bring that kind of normalcy, like this is a person, this is somebody that's going to take care of your mother, that's going to, that I've had good experiences with, or this agency. Sometimes I have to go back and say, this agency only really provides people that I've been so impressed by, you know, that have worked so hard. And I've also brought up, do you realize how hard it is for a caregiver to walk into somebody's home and especially a live-in that gives up everything to stay with your mother? I think bringing some of that, this is a person that has a normal life beyond this, and the color of their skin is the last thing that's important here. It's taking care of your mother that's important. But you do have to choose your words kind of carefully to try and keep things on an even as a keel, because they are your client. So it's, but you should know, and you do, you know your clients well enough to know how to choose those words. There's a lot of psychosocial, I'm a nurse, but I feel like sometimes I wish I had more skills of social workers to pull out of my hat. But I think it's impressing families with, this is a caregiver that does a great job, that you will learn to be happy that your mother is safe with somebody. And I think trying to get them to take the color out of the picture was the best we could do. But choosing those words carefully is tough. And I've had many agencies that just would practically slam the phone down. You know, if you tried to suggest that you wanted someone from, you know, Eastern Europe.
Hmm. Yeah. That's some great suggestions. I'm gonna work on those.
Well, I've been the victim of some reverse discrimination, I guess you might call it. I was the assistant director of nursing, the RNAC, in a skilled nursing home, not-for-profit, Quaker, and in Pennsylvania. I had a Black aide I respected very much. We worked well together for years. And one day she hadn't gone in to bathe a resident. It was getting near lunchtime, and I just kind of said to her something like, you know, do you think you're going to get to this residence soon? It's, you know, it's almost time for lunch or something. She just went out in the common area, called me a bitch. And a lot of people around, you know, this is at the front desk area. And I just kind of said, you know, I was talking to you about the residence needs or something. And so I just kind of walked away from it. Went back to the administrator and told her that this was inappropriate, that kind of language was inappropriate for anybody, any role, you know, whatever the level of care person was. And because she was Black, I really believe, I never got an apology. And I was totally justified. I was totally kind. I felt totally confident in the way I handled her, as me being a supervisor, my responsibility to, kind of address the issue that was going on with the resident. Even though both of us had worked there for years, and like I said, we had kind of a nice, friendly, you know, professional relationship. So I thought, until that happened. And I lost a lot of respect for her when that happened. And she never came and apologized to me. The administrator never called, you know, made it, would never. So I left there before too long. That was one of the reasons, but, you know, it can work the other way. But I have run a home care agency a couple times, and it's very hurtful when we have really good, we know we have very good caregivers. We know they're going to be a good fit in a home, and families are reluctant to let them come in because they question their language skills, their accent, and their color. And, you know, no matter how much reassurance you give them, sometimes there's a lot of hesitancy and uncomfortableness. So I really try to nurtured and supported a lot of caregivers so that they felt that they were good people and tried to always find them work, you know, despite those who were obviously somewhat prejudiced.
Well, and I think you bring up an excellent point, Karen, that we all bring prejudice. We all bring, I mean, we judge quickly. We like to lump people into categories. We like to, you know, we hear somebody's accent. We hear somebody's, you know, name. We'll jump to conclusions. So, you know, I think we're certainly all guilty of that. And to some extent, maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not. But you know, we always try to we want to understand people. And so we quickly gather information and then we put it into our pocket. We put it into the cubby holes, you know, of our experience and what we know. So, I think certainly we've all been, I'm from the North. I've lived in the South for, most of my life, but, you know, I talk quicker than most Texans. I don't have a Texas twang. People will ask me, you know, I'm an outsider, even though I've lived in the South for, you know, since I was in grade school. I get it. I don't think that's the same as being, you know, stopped by police because of my color and dragged out of a car. Just being asked where I'm from. Or being told I wouldn't understand because I'm not from the South. So those are, you know, certainly I'm not equating them at all. But anybody else have experiences with, you know, how you've handled racism, how you think we should handle? It's a quiet bunch.
So this is Tracy again. And yeah, we can sometimes confront it with clients. I think we should confront it with our staff and our interns. And I just attended a webinar for Alzheimer's, and something that just to be aware of is that as people experience more dementia with Alzheimer's, one part of the brain that is not affected and that people don't forget so much is their ability to swear, and which includes racial slurs. And so maybe when it comes to people with dementia, there's little that could be done except maybe to educate people that's part of the illness. It'd be the same category where, you know, some people with Alzheimer's are sexually inappropriate. So those areas of being disinhibited are not erased memory wise, and as other areas are erased more, those come out more frequently. I thought that was very interesting.
Very good. Yeah, and I agree. Kind of helping folks understand the disease process and you know, how we can't hold them to the same, I don't know if I want to say standard, but I don't, you know, not hold them to the same consequences maybe. Yeah.
I have a story. So yeah. My mother had live-ins before she went into long-term care, and it was my first exposure to care management. And this is 4 years ago. So we had round-the-clock care by a family. The mother was an aide, and I had known her for years. She'd helped me with my husband when he was sick, and a friend of mine had a home health agency, and she was trained by her. Her two daughters were in nursing school, so they helped too. So remember, this is round-the-clock care. And I'm over at my mother's. I usually went over for dinner once a week, and I'm sitting there, and she's sundowning, dementia, she never had diagnosis of dementia, but she was having sundowning. And she said to me, don't talk to those colored girls. And I thought to myself, how do I respond to that? Did they hear it? Did Molly hear it in the other room? Molly and her daughters are like family to my family. Many of you know I'm the oldest of seven children, and there are 17 grandchildren, and now there are 5 great-grandchildren. And any event that we have, Molly and her family, because she took care of my mother for almost 5 years, are invited to. But how do you respond to that? And then how do you respond to Molly if she overheard it? So I remember that very distinctly on trying to figure out what to say. And it wasn't that long ago. Mom, that's not appropriate.
Did you ever address it to Molly and ask her?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I think Molly knew that my mother did have some prejudice, but my mother loved Molly and Molly loved my mother. And because of they formed a really tight bond because they were together all the time. And I guess Molly she's African, and she overlooked it. But I remember thinking I wanted to crawl into the wall when my mother said it, thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a client do similar thing with Hispanic aid, and we had to talk with the agency and make sure that they understood that the aid needed to understand, and she did.
Yeah, this was private.
This was not personal.
So.
I'm sorry, Emma. Yes.
That's the thing. I my background is I grew up in New Orleans, downriver from New Orleans. So, I would have knockdown, drag out discussions with my dad, who was 40 years my senior, and about, racism. And then, he let me go to Rice University in Houston. So I went to Texas when I was 18 or 19 and found, oh my God, it's here too, with the Latino population. So, when my mother was on hospice and dying, she would have me come to her from California to New Orleans to sing to her. And we had so many discussions, one of which was, Mom, you've made me such an artful, empathic, kind, successful woman, And she said, oh, don't call yourself a woman. I'm like, what? She said, only blacks are called women. We're ladies. And it shocked me. I'm like, I was, 44 years old and just learning of the language, and the fundamental, a prejudice, the installation of language and how it does color everything. And, for me, I guess when I'm in these situations because I worked in hospice for over 10 years and to be, like staying in the inquiry of like, oh, well, what do you need here? And do you feel unsafe when someone comes into your home? And so I guess just, finding some kind of conversation, exploration, inquiry about what safety is, what's your primary need at this point, how to support that. Maybe a care manager needs to escort an aide, to a couple of visits till, for familiarity, for the sense of safety until that's, and just stay in the inquiry. I don't know. It's such a big topic. I'm afraid of it myself.
I think you nailed I think you hit the nail on the head with that. It's such a big issue. I'm afraid of it. But I think as we've discussed today that we still need to face it, even if we're afraid of it. And we will say the wrong things. We will do the wrong things. And if we just kind of love each other through it, we can hopefully make the world a better place and make everybody feel loved and appreciated and wanted and cared for, which is really what I think all of us want. You know, we want for ourselves, we want for our clients, we want for our families. So hopefully that comes through. So I just, one aside, Emma, that I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio originally, and we moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma when I was in grade school. And Tulsa's been on the news recently because of Trump's rally there. And, there was a huge race riot there in 1921 that we did learn about in school, by the way. I know that everybody says, oh, and they never talked about it. I learned it in my Oklahoma history class in junior high. And then my first job as a social worker was in North Tulsa. It was in the Greenwood District. So I worked right there where, all the buildings had been burned to the ground. They were all, newer. They'd all been built since 1921 when I worked there as a social worker. But I felt like there was more prejudice back in Cincinnati than there was in Tulsa. And there was plenty in Tulsa. Don't get me wrong. There was plenty of it in Tulsa. We'd go back to Tulsa. We'd go back to Cincinnati to visit relatives. And my one grandmother was in Price Hill, very, very poor part of Cincinnati, and my other grandparents were in suburbia, but there was prejudice everywhere. So I think if we just face it head on, and I think identifying what in ourselves we have that might interfere, because again, we all have prejudices, and so where are we getting in the way of that? So I know it's, we've got 1 minute.
Yes, we've got 1 minute. Yes, I was just going to say thank you very much.
I'm going to hand that back off to Tani then.
Yeah, well, thank you. And thank all of you for taking time out of your busy day today to have this discussion with us. We really appreciate it. And thank you, staff and board, for joining all of us. And we're going to try to continue these once a month and come up with topics that would be of interest to talk about. Hope you all have a great weekend and take good care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. Everyone.
Now.
Thank you.